The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
The Fold is brought to you by oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Nau mai, hoki mai, kia The Fold, e mihi nei, ko Duncan Greve, tōku ingoa. My guest today is Claire Mabey, who is the books editor at The Spinoff, the third person to hold that position. And I've been wanting to talk to her forever. She's a brilliant writer. I mean, everyone who's done that job, surprise, surprise, has been an extraordinary writer. And the writing crackles with a passion for the subject. You know, the most recent thing she wrote that we published was her obituary or tribute to the writer Renee, which I don't know, it's just so vivid and knowledgeable and passionate, and it's just, you know, if you haven't read it, please go and read it. But I mean, that's basically the fact that she wrote that, I don't know, within hours of her passing, it kind of, all of that knowledge is in her, all of the feeling is in her, and that's why she's so good at her job. And this is, on some level, if not a side hustle, it's a part-time job for sure, because her main thing has been working on creating festivals, live events that grow out of the culture of books and writing in New Zealand. We talk about some of this on the podcast, but she founded Pirate and Queen, which is an events company with her partner Andrew Laking, around 10 years ago, and out of that came Lit Crawl and Verb festivals. And she also has worked on the New Zealand Festival of the Arts and the Auckland Arts Festival and a whole bunch of things that kind of bring together the slow and private work of writing and put them into public spaces. And as she talks about, like, the way that those events are is quite different from the way that the sort of establishment events are typically structured, and that's because she kind of considers herself fundamentally a bit of a troublemaker. And I think that's quite a cool way of conceiving of why a Claire Mabey joint feels different from the way it might be done in other people's hands. So the reason I wanted to have this conversation is because I've been thinking a lot lately about books and why they seem so healthy, where other cultural forms, you know, music, TV, sort of pop culture type stuff, just isn't thriving in quite the same way. And I've got my own theories on that, which I won't bore you with, but I really wanted to get someone who was a lot closer to the action to kind of describe what the last 10 years have looked like and why this this particular form, this culture, in an era when you might expect it to be failing, you know, like there are a whole host of reasons why different cultures are kind of being outcompeted and attention spans are supposed to have gone to hell. Somehow books are still out here thriving and evolving and fighting. And that's the meat of what this conversation's about. I really, like, massively enjoyed it, even if you don't think you're interested in books, even if you think maybe that's a bit outside of the media lane again. It's not. It's all relevant. I think we can all learn a lot from how, you know, the publishing and book and write books and writing worlds have responded to this era, and Claire's very particular, super up close view on that. So, yeah, really enjoyed this. This is Claire Mabey, books editor of The Spinoff, and so much more on The Fold. Tēnā koe, Claire. Welcome to The Fold.
Thank you, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited about this. I first sort of messaged you about it like 5 months ago, and it's great to be finally in the same room and able to do it. And I'm excited to do it because my main way of understanding what's happening in the world of books is through reading your coverage on The Spinoff. And based on that, you know, it feels like it's thriving in a way that a lot of other cultural forms are kind of maybe not at the moment. And I'd really like to sort of figure out whether that's true and why. But I wonder if we could start by talking a bit about you and how you came to be so bookish.
I am really bookish. I think I was lucky to grow up in a house where reading was a thing. So my parents always read to us. We always had heaps of books. And both mum and dad read to us. And I think I just absorbed that as a habit really young. And then I was definitely one of those kids at around kind of 10, 11, 12 who just hoovered books. I just read and read and read. And I think there's a definite pattern that happens when if you're at that age and you read a lot, those books kind of imprint on you. And I think almost everybody I know who's a very bookish adult had the same experience of kind of those books. I don't know, they just do something to you at that age. Like they just give you whole worlds and characters and people that you, in a way, morph into your own personality. So for me, Anne of Green Gables was epic. Like I just loved her so much and I read all of her books over and over and over again. And to me, she, it sounds so weird and a little bit creepy, but she's very real to me. And I think that, I don't know, it just shapes the way that you think about being an adult and work and life. Or for me, I'm definitely someone that has to work in a field I'm passionate about. Otherwise, I find it hard to be motivated. So I think books for me has always just been a kind of very central part of my life, even though there was a big patch in my early 20s where I did not read, I have to confess.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I know.
It just bleak stopped.
Time. Yeah, I think I was just having a lot of fun as a student, and even though I studied English, so I suppose I did read a lot for school, but I didn't read for pleasure. And I think I came back to that in my late 20s when I was kind of, I realised I had been missing it.
That's interesting, right? Because, you know, if you were to look at your career from where you stand now, it sort of seems like you'd always been leading to the kind of the career that you've ultimately built. You know, how did you sort of start to conceive of books as not just this kind of private pleasure, albeit one that you strayed from briefly, but as a place where you could build a career in?
That's such a good question, because actually when I think about it, I remember when I went to uni and I'd come, you know, I was a kid of the 90s, went through that whole careers counsellor phase at high school where if you're good at English, you do law. That's kind of the option. So I went to Otago to do law and kind of liked it, but just knew that I was never going to be a lawyer. I just knew I just did not have that passion in me. But what I loved in the classes that I went to were the English classes. But even then, I just did not know that there could be a career in books. Like I remember freaking out about it and thinking, I have no idea what I'm doing with my life. And I felt like that for years. Like I just didn't know what my career would be. And in a funny way, I still feel like that. Like I feel like my jobs have been a series of flukes. And I think, I think honestly, I finished uni, wanted to keep studying, but was so confused about what I would do. Like I kind of wanted to do a master's degree because I wanted to keep studying English and be in that uni bubble, but was never able to decide on a topic. So I did the Fitzroy publishing course and thought, yes, this is it, I'll be a publisher. But I feel like I shouldn't say this, but I didn't love the course. I just found it, I think I was too young and too stuck in my university ways, my party ways. And for me, the course was like this quite abrupt introduction into work. And it wasn't the kind of hustling around a publishing office with copies and books piled up against the floor. You know, like it just, I had romanticized things so much that I was again freaking out. And my first job that I got was as an editor at the Parliamentary Council office. And I just died. A little part of me died. Because it was this editing job and I was like, cool, I'm starting a career in publishing. But I was so bored and it was just not me. Like, I'd always been an artsy person. And this office was like suit and ties and 9 to 5 editing legislation, which had its interesting moments, but I was like, this cannot be work. Like, this can't be work.
That is quite a hard move from the sort of Otago scene to editing Ledge.
And kind of hilarious looking back because I was definitely panicking, I think. And anyway, what had happened was during the Fishy Road publishing course, the great thing about that is that you get these cool posts. So I'd done a 2-week posting up at Penguin and had met a publicist there who was awesome, an awesome person. And I just remember emailing her going, any ideas for jobs? And she was like, oh, yeah, the Auckland Arts Festival is hiring for the next festival. And I had a little bit of experience at festivals. So I emailed them and was so lucky to get a job on their marketing team. So moved to Auckland on a horrendous salary, I remember, like so bad. I think it was like 30 grand or something. And but I was delighted. And that was kind of the start of my festival passion. I just loved it. It was so hard. It was such a hard job, but it was manic and fast, and I felt like I was in the world that I wanted to be in. So it was kind of arts festivals that pulled me into book festivals first.
Right.
Yeah.
And but even then, it's quite a leap from I'm interested in working in this place and enjoying it to what you've done with Pirate and Queen, which is you're sort of building these things from scratch and in some cases. What made you take that leap? Because that's a big one.
Yeah, I guess at the time it didn't feel like a big leap, and I think that is definitely one of the reasons that I feel like I'm missing a risk chromosome or something. Like I genuinely do wonder about that, because starting off on our own felt really natural at the time, and I think I had just enough experience and just too little experience. I was very naive. And I think I just had heaps of energy for making something. And I could see at the time that there was stuff to be made. Like, I saw that there was a gap for showcasing the kind of real indie grassroots literary world that I could see. And my partner Andy, who we started this together, he'd been an artist forever. Like, he'd never had a stable job. So he was very comfortable as well, just making something. And it didn't actually matter if it failed. And I think that was a key thing. Like, we didn't really think about success or failure at all. We just thought about making the thing. And so that's how it started. We just saw there was a gap. We had the energy and enough experience to pull it off, but not enough to freak us out. Yeah.
That's really interesting, that idea, because it's if you think about where a lot of the sort of, like, I grew up in the music scene and people were forever putting on like a sort of like a punk or an indie festival, from the incredibly lo-fi, like in a community hall, to things that are a bit more elaborate. But there was very much a culture of, no one's going to fund this. You just have to make it and, figure the rest out later. And that ethos seems to be a little bit in Litcrawl versus the very kind of, controlled and understood world of the kind of established festivals. Like, it feels like it's more akin to that spirit. What was it that you were trying to do? Do you want to talk about Litcrawl in particular? I think it's...
Yeah, Litcrawl, I quite like breaking the rules, and I always have been. I was quite, I'm the oldest of three kids. We grew up in like suburban Tauranga, and my thrills when I was little was running around like in people's backyards, stealing their fruit off the trees, as you can do in Tauranga. And it was that, there's something about that spirit of like breaking a boundary that I've always liked and that I've liked about the arts. And I think Litcrawl came together pretty easily because Wellington was so suited to it, because we have this geographic bubble and this incredible culture of independent business. So, and that is to me what Wellington is made out of, is these retail and hospo communities that have started their own thing and just kept bashing through the barriers that Wellington can pop up. And I saw the same thing in the literary community. Like, there were all these cool journals and writers who just kept on making something without money. You know, money wasn't even a question. And so Lit Crawl, to me, presented this opportunity of bringing people together in that spirit of independent business, like literally inside those businesses, and just completely going against what the major festivals were doing, which was that much more formal experience of going into a theatre, having a ticket, sitting down, you know, like, you know what to expect in those spaces, and they're definitely there for a reason and good reasons. But I think Lit Crawl just gives you this kind of energy that is fun and that is a little bit naughty. Like, there is a sense of like, oh, I'm here after hours. There's a poetry reading in a record shop. This is kind of weird, but it suits. Like, I just like that sense of the community taking back the physical city.
Mm.
Something about that.
Because these things can and really should be read as, on some level, a critique of whatever the big establishment thing is. How did those kind of worlds respond to it? Because A, you started there, and B, you know, you would ultimately end up working in aspects of them again. What was the sort of response to doing something that was a bit more punkish?
Well, it's actually really lovely, because I was working for the New Zealand Festival of the Arts at the time we started Lit Crawl. And Sue Patterson, who was the executive director of at that time, dearly departed Sue, she was so supportive. And she let me and Andy like take over a whole corner of the office. Meg Williams, who was the marketing director at the time, was just like, I'll sponsor your paper for the print programs. Like, they were really into it.
And that's gorgeous.
It was gorgeous. And I have this photo of the very first Lit Crawl with Sue Patterson. Anna Cameron, who was my boss at the time, she was the producer, because I was working on the writers' program for the main festival, and Meg sitting on the floor at Ferret Bookshop, with the little faces looking up at the writer like kids, and it's that was the vibe. Like, it was all in. Yeah.
So just sort of zooming out a little bit, I mean, this is kind of roughly 10 years or so ago now, which is about 5 years after I remember reading a bunch of stories about how books were done. And, you know, because I was sitting in, you know, music publishing or music media rather, watching our thing sort of cave in on itself and paying attention to all these kind of related creative fields. And there was a thought that some combination of the internet and Amazon was sort of just creating a tomb around books as we know it. And that doesn't seem to have happened. The publishing world feels quite vital in a lot of ways, at least from, you know, the position outside of it that I look at. Is that accurate, do you think?
I think it is. And I never believed that books were going to die. I just knew maybe wanted to think that, but I just think the community of people that need books in their lives as physical objects, but also as ways of learning and escape, all those things that books do, is too big and too demanding. And I also think the physical bookshop is such a key community space. Like, there's something about bookshops that is very important in a hard to explain way. But I also think we have to be careful about that, because I do think while the industry to me, from my end of it at this stage, does seem incredibly healthy, I can see that the cost of living crisis is hitting sales. I do think that is happening. And I do think that if we're not careful And by that I mean continuing to support independent publishing, independent bookshops, book buying as a cultural thing. I do think that there could be problems in the future.
It's interesting, right, because that culture of independent bookshops is actually probably the key differentiator between the music world that I came from, where both of them had these big chain mega stores which performed a function. You know, I'm thinking about like Borders and Barnes & Noble versus like a Tower Records or you know, Sounds in the local context. And they all, those big chain things, got unwieldy, collapsed, and most of them are gone. Some of them have reemerged in different forms. But the independent bookshop, much like the independent record shop, had that particular role. And the indie record shops are mostly gone, but the bookshops are, you know, can feel more vibrant than ever. And it does feel like there was almost like a concerted effort to say, don't let these things fall. You do not know what you'll lose. And that, you know, you can see that in the way that shops like Unity, which have supported us, and Time Out, and, you know, there's much more that
and
are still going.
COVID really elicited that panic in people. I think people really realized that those places were important to them on the other side of it. And so there was a lot of book buying going on, you know, the online book buying. But, you know, Vic Books closed this year. Like, it is happening. There is a danger, I think. I don't think that books are impervious to the fluctuations of the economy. So that does make me nervous. But publishing seems incredibly vital. And there is now, I can see some fierce competition going on between publishers in New Zealand. There's so many books coming out. Like, this year was extraordinary. I was inundated with amazing books. And I could see there's this real urgency. And I also think among people are writing hard and seriously. I think there's this incredibly healthy culture of writing in New Zealand.
Yeah, and like that's actually probably the thing that feels most vital is the object itself, you know, setting aside the you know, the sustaining audience and economic elements of it, that somehow over the past 10 years the sort of diversity and intent and cultural being into New Zealand literature and all, you know, in quite a broad-ranging way, it feels really like it's almost never been so healthy. Well, you know, if that's true, what do you think is driving the sort of supply side of it, if you will?
That's a good question. I think this is quite a lofty response, but I do think that in times like this where the future is very uncertain and it is harder and harder to see the future, I think the urge to write your story gets stronger somehow. I think that sense of an ending, a forthcoming ending, makes you do the things that you want to do. And I'd wonder if that's why people are taking to the page or Substack. Like, I'm interested in the rise of the newsletter format for creative writing. There's just a flourishing. And I wonder if it's part of that. I do think, though, over the years, the creative writing schools, so in Auckland and Wellington and other places around the country, Christchurch, there is now cohort after cohort of people who have trained in creative writing, and I can see that work starting to come through more and more and through the publications. So, yeah, I guess the culture of writing is growing and developing. And there's probably lots of reasons, but I do think the state of the world might be driving part of it.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
To sort of flip it on to, into something that's a bit more, well, I don't think it's banal, but it's certainly a lot more kind of basic. But there's been a lot of trend pieces written about the rise of book talk and the,
yeah.
you know, the sort of semi-irony of this like ultra short form format being a place that people go to sort of gush and champion this activity that feels a long way from consuming short form video content. But it does seem to have had quite an extraordinary impact on certain titles and publishers and authors. What's your sort of perspective on, you know, how significant you know, the book talk scene has been?
I think it's massive. It's every week when I look at the Unity Books bestseller list that we publish on a Friday, you can see book talk trending titles in there every week, and I think it's incredible. And I'm in two minds about it. On the one hand, I think it's amazing that there's an online community that is that influenced that will go and buy a book. I think that's great. On the other hand, I think engaging with TikTok, I'm old, you know, like I'm an ancient millennial, and I tried to get into it. I tried to get into BookTok as a habit, just to kind of try and read the trends and just see how it all worked. But I find it frittering, like the pace of it and the, yeah, just the onslaught of it.
It feels on some level antithetical to the kind of deep space you need to get into.
Yeah, I find it really weird. But I think it is hugely influential, and you can see it. Like, it's very clear. Some books just go off. You know, Madeline Miller, whose book The Song of Achilles came out a decade ago, just had a huge year because of TikTok. There's lots and lots of examples like that. So I think it's a definite thing, and I think if you can harness it, then good on you.
yeah, absolutely. Well, another sort of trend that seems to have taken off this past decade or so is a sort of a basically reconsidering or taking more seriously and building kind of fandoms and scenes around what were once seen as kind of less fashionable areas of the publishing world. I'm thinking of young adult, like YA is obviously a huge example, but same goes for children's and fantasy and sci-fi. And they're being taken a bit more seriously in circles which would once have disdained them. What's driving that, do you think?
That's such an interesting question. I'm really glad you asked that. I think that, well, I was a reader, you know, a really intense reader at that age, like that middle grade to YA age. And I think that if that happened to you, you have an interest in an adult in those books. So I think adults reading children's books is quite awesome and essential. And there's a writer in the UK called Catherine Rundle who published a whopper this year called Impossible Creatures. So it's a middle grade novel, massive marketing campaign. I haven't seen anything like it before. I was in the UK this year and just saw it everywhere, like billboards, tube posters, massive. And the book matches the hype. Like, she's a bloody good writer. All her books are beautiful, very kind of essential reading for that age group. But I think also essential reading for an adult who loves that genre, and they do. And she wrote an essay that's been published in book form about why adults should read children's books. And I think, I honestly think Catherine Rundle might be responsible for a real resurgence, like personally responsible. But I also think that genre, if you are someone who has had quite a time out of reading but you would like to get back to it, that's the genre you can go to, because they're hooky, they're fun, there's real emotional depth, there's lots of real world impact, storytelling. Like, those books can get you back in. And I think also, if you're a parent and you are worried about your child reading, and I hear this quite a lot, like there is, I think, a worrying decline in children reading, I think those are the books you go to as well, to read together or to try and entice your kid. So I think that there is many reasons why those books are on the rise, but they're also really good. Like there's so much good publishing in that genre. There's brilliant writers. You know, we've had Philip Pullman as an example for a long time, but now we've also got Karen Millward Hargrave. We've got Catherine Rundle. There's just a lot of really brilliant storytellers in that space, and I think that they reach an adult audience as well.
Switching back to New Zealand, there, you know, in recent years there's been a real surge in Māori writing and writers, and you know, queer poetry and this whole intersectional space that has got a kind of quite like a sort of a swag and an attitude about it a lot of the time, in a way that like it's being kind of treated and framed and absorbed in a different way, certainly seems to from the outside, that than it might have been historically. You know, is that true? And again, like how has that sort of impacted the broader world of books in New Zealand?
I think it is true, and I'm not an expert, so it's so this is from what I've learned, I think. But I suspect that Māori writing has always been boundary breaking and had something completely different to it because it's Māori writing, but also to get out from under the colonial publishing system took a really long time, and it's taken real ferocious, sustained work by Māori writers up and down the country to make that happen. And I think what we're seeing now is the results of that commitment, but also people like Huia Publishers, who have been over 30 years publishing Māori writers, super successful indie publishing model. I mean, it's pretty incredible what they've done. But I also think what I've learned over the past decade is that for a lot of Māori writers, I think, book publishing is not the end game at all. It's this collective shared storytelling that can take many forms. So I think if a book comes out of it, that's awesome. But there's so many other ways that Māori writing emerges. And I think we see that in the newsletter format, we see it in social media. There's this incredible flourishing of Instagram poetry, for example. Like, I think what I've learned is the colonial mindset champions the book as the be-all and end-all of publishing, but in the decolonizing process, that has been reimagined and re-understood. And I think that's awesome. And I think that's what we're seeing. And then we're also seeing it when there is a book. And I think like Whiti Hiriaka's novel, Kūrongo Tuku, which won the Ockham, is such an inventive publication. Like you can read it from the back or the front. It just completely takes apart how you read a novel. And I think that we will keep seeing things like that, kind of redefining that the book, but also redefining what publishing is and what the relationship between writing and publishing is. I also think we'll see in the next decade a flourishing in writing in Te Reo Māori instead of, right now there's a real dominance of translating English into Māori. And I think, the hope is that that will metamorphosize into writing into our Māori original stories.
So this is like largely been a story of cool things that are working. Like, you know, if you were to sort of stand and, you know, 10 years ago and look at the world, be given a vision of the world as it is now, you'd be quite stoked with that given the position there. But like all creative communities, everything's all, you know, can't always be going well, and we love to have a complain. What's hard? What are people struggling with within, you know, writing and books at the moment?
I think that money money is a problem. I think that the lack of funding for Creative New Zealand is a massive issue. Not many people get awarded grants to write a book, and that means that it's already, you know, people who are able to write books often have really good jobs, or, you know, they're able to take time off, or, you know, I think it's just that equity thing. There's this, and I think that's getting worse as the cost of living gets higher and CNZ money goes down. Yeah, I think it's a huge issue. I think, I think money, honestly, is probably the biggest barrier, money and time. And people have gotten around that, of course, for years, but I think it's harder now. I definitely can see it everywhere I look in the arts, is just the cost of making something is so much more than it used to be even a decade ago. I don't think that we could have started Litcrawl now. When I look back, like, our rent was really low, the cost of doing everything was low, we could pull that off. And I think now it's just impossible to, unless you're already very well capitalised, it's pretty hard to start something up. And I think sometimes you can translate that concept to writing a book. Like, you need time, you need to have a delusional faith in yourself that you can do it. and that's hard. And I think sometimes, like, things like grants can prop up your delusional faith. So, yeah, I wish CNZ had more money. There was just more. I just wish there was more opportunities to support writers to do the writing.
So, yeah, and CNZ seems itself very aware that things aren't operating correctly. It's just put out a report, New Mirrors, which did you contribute to that?
Yeah.
I can imagine that you might have. And the sort of central, well, one of the big ideas out of it is this idea of an arts media centre that in some ways parallels what the Science Media Centre has been seen as quite successful in doing over some time. What do you make of that as a sort of, it's obviously not a total solution, but as a sort of a salve to the idea?
I think that increasing arts cover is, of course, a brilliant thing. I think we have seen a huge decrease in space for reviewing and general book cover and arts cover. I don't think we've ever cracked that high-level media for the arts. Like, there's, I honestly think every single conference I've been to in the last 10 years has done that whole what if arts got as much cover as sports question.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, maybe we'll get there one day. I think the media
sports
center
has got a lot less coverage than it used to as well.
Yeah,
like,
yes.
People in arts probably haven't necessarily been paying attention to.
No, probably not. But I think, yes, I think an increase in cover, especially investigative arts journalism, that's what I feel it could be quite revolutionary, because I do think there are a lot of there are stories involved in the structural dissemination of money. There's stories involved in the structural kind of culture of the arts at value, at kind of bureaucratic levels. So I think kind of telling some of those stories is really essential. My kind of cynical self, though, does often wonder who cares and why. Like, I do wonder, how do we make non-arts, well, people who aren't involved in the making of art every day, why should they care? And I wonder if, I don't know if we've cracked that yet, and I think it's a perpetual challenge for anybody working in the arts, is to kind of find that audience outside of your core audience, because they're there, they're definitely there.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I mean, I don't know, I was just talking about it with a friend yesterday. Like, there's bands that come to Wellington that I love that I don't even, like, they've been and gone before I've even noticed. And I wonder, like, what is that? Tell me. Because the marketing is there, but what is it that stops you from looking? Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a freaking massive question.
It is a massive question.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the arts coverage thing kind of, you know, if you spill it out over, you know, like the same kind of pop culture stuff that's right next to it, you know, I guess my sort of cynical take on it is that tends to be come from the practitioners who want publicity for their book. They want the right kind. They just want someone to say their book fucking rules. Sometimes their book's going to suck. And what happens then? And when it's the same organisation that is tasked with trying to propagate both those things, you know, on one hand it might fund a book being made and also a reviewer saying that sucks. I think that's actually awesome. That's a system working. But people are going to get mad about that, and it's not uncomplicated.
The reviewing thing, I think, is such a ongoing and interesting debate. I was at a party the other night and I was talking to another books editor. And
how many of those are there?
There's like three maybe. But he was pointing out a couple of people in the room and he was like, that guy gave a really bad review. And yeah. I was like, well, we're at the same party. Like, that's a great sign.
I find
sign.
It's stressful. Like, you know, I quite often am in rooms with people who I've said their thing sucked. And
yeah,
it's very hectic for a while, but you end up being like, fine. You know, at least I do.
I personally hate the feeling of giving a bad review. I don't. Or a critical review. Like, I do find it hard because it is my community, like the people that I hugely respect. But on the other hand, I really respect proper critique. I think it's essential.
Well, no one sets out to do the bad thing. It's like, it's heartbreaking. Like, I mean, when I get notes on a feature, I can kind of spend a few hours in a funk. I can only imagine what it's like if you lay yourself out there and then someone says, not good enough.
Especially because writing a book is a freaking heroic thing to do, you know, to finish.
And so personal at times, you know. Eesh.
Oh, but that is, you know, as my partner Andy always says, he's so good about this. He's like, it doesn't matter if they like it. It doesn't matter if they don't like it. That's the rule with art. You just got to keep doing it.
You do. You do. lastly, you know, we're just over a year since you, speaking of heroic acts, took up the mantle of being the third editor of the spin-off books coverage. How's it going?
Well, I love it. I'm very grateful for the job. Honestly, I think it's a super privileged job. I was very nervous starting because I'd never worked in the media. And I didn't. I realised I was completely at sea with the industry. Like, I was so comfortable in my book world, but the media world felt to me like a completely different kettle of fish, which it is. So I feel like I've learned a lot over the year, which feels really good. I've really enjoyed understanding a new context and meeting other people in the industry who are so interesting and so clear and curious about the media. And I love being able to support the industry. Like, I feel that it's such an essential part of the spin-off and part of the book sector. I always wish I could do more, though. Like, I'm always like, oh man, I wish I had more budget, as everybody does. You know, it's the same old thing. Like, there's never enough. There's never enough time, money, people to cover what is out there. But I think it's a really exciting gig. And I, now that I've done 1 year, I can feel slightly more comfortable in the media and can kind of start to see how things could shape in the future, which is also interesting.
I mean, from my perspective, you're doing the most extraordinary job, and yeah, like, it's amazing to watch and to read. I do actually have one last question. I lied before. Given the timing of this and the fact that a lot of people, when they think about their summer, they think about finally reading in a more sustained way than they can during their working year, do you want to, like, pick two or three books that people might miss that you think they should really give some consideration to?
I might cry saying this, but we just lost Renee, Amazing.
You wrote the most
writer.
Gorgeous piece. Like, if you're listening, please go and read Claire's. I don't know if it's an obituary, but it's a tribute to her anyway.
Yeah, she was just an extraordinary woman and a brilliant writer. And her memoir, These Two Hands by Makaro Press, is an awesome read. And she's very funny and she's very bold. And her life story is just an inspiration.
It's so the sweep that. Of it, right?
Yeah, she just embodies that whole you're never too old to keep going. Like she just didn't, she was very forward looking and very, she gave herself a lot of respect. And I think that's an amazing lesson for everybody.
Let's just go with that. Okay. I mean, that's a pretty strong wreck, and I'm going to do it. And, hey, Claire, thanks so much. This has been really fun.
Thank you. That was fun.
Love your coverage, honestly. It's amazing.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.